is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Israel is holding yet another protest against judicial reforms by Netanyahu's cabinet, one day after parliament gave its initial approval to the overhaul. Iran says it recently seized a smuggling tanker in the Persian Gulf region, despite the U.S. military's intervention to help it escape. Also coming up, China warns the U.S. against sending cluster munitions to Ukraine, saying that the move could have humanitarian consequences. Thanks for joining us. Israelis have once again taken to the streets to protest against judicial overhaul proposed by the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The protests erupted after the Knesset gave its initial approval to a bill that limits some powers of Israel's top court. It is part of the reform proposed by the Netanyahu administration. Clashes have been reported between police and protesters who blocked a highway linking to occupied outlets. The bill must still be passed in two more readings to become law. The changes have sparked one of the biggest ever protest movements in Israel. Opponents say that Netanyahu, who is on trial on corruption charges, is trying to use the overhaul to quash possible judgments against him. James Thring is a peace activist who joins us from London. James Thring, welcome to the program. I mean, you know, when you take a look at these protests, they are entering its eighth month, perhaps. We're in the seventh month, I believe. Why wouldn't the Prime Minister look at that and reach the conclusion that, you know, they're not going to give up? The people were out there protesting, but yet it's pushing through this, which I believe still needs two more, I guess, votes. Isn't that pushing, even though it's occupying that land, of an uprising that may result in him not even having a post or a job?
Yes, I think you could be right. I dare say he's so desperate to avoid being put in prison for his corruption charges that he'll try anything. And it's not unusual for Israeli prime ministers to try everything under the sun to get their own way. They'll even kill people. So I don't suppose he cares too much about democracy or the crowds, although huge numbers of people demonstrating that this is a crime in itself, in a way, because even the defense minister has had to resign or been sacked because he said it was, quote, a danger to state security, what Netanyahu was proposing, which puts a rather bleak slant on the whole operation. It does show that he's so desperate, and I can only think that it must be because of his personal vulnerability in the courts.
I'm sure you've seen some of the scenes of the protests, the ones that involve police, I guess, beating up on some of the protesters or taking them and handcuffing them, taking them away. Do you think that it's reaching a point where that's going to be a more common scene, given the anger that is now going to be unleashed with the fact that they're pushing this through? Because, you know, these they've been out on the streets for 7 months. They're not getting the result that they want, and I think the anger is going to spill over from what it looks like. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know where it can spill over to. They can't very well take the army on, but as I said, if the Defense Department is against what's happening, they might well have the army on their side. Now, quite what that would mean, I don't know, but it's plausible that if the army is on the side of the protesters, even if only half of them are, it might mean some kind of onslaught on the very seat of Netanyahu himself. I wouldn't like to suggest whether it would be his personal residence or simply the Knesset, but it certainly makes it look a possibility. I'm very encouraged by Gallant, the former defense minister, what he said.
Of course, there's always the possibility that it's not Netanyahu running the show all the way. I mean, you have this extreme far-right cabinet, which, by the way, was called a very radical one by the U.S. President Joe Biden, who described it as such. How much of a role do you think the U.S. can play if things get out of hand, which apparently they look like it has gotten out of hand already?
Yes, I hope that Biden will see what's really going on. At the moment, his latest statement was Israel is a vibrant democracy. Well, that may be true, but it's certainly not a democracy from the Palestinian point of view. And we've yet to see whether this democratic outcry does have any democratic effect. And I think it's possible that if it doesn't, even Biden might reconsider supporting Netanyahu, and perhaps that might mean a little bit less pressure on the Palestinians, because they're the people who are really suffering from Netanyahu's aggressive right-wing fascist policies, and I feel very sorry for them. And it's rather encouraging that so many people have come out on the street who are inadvertently helping the Palestinians by interrupting Netanyahu's attempt to squash legal censure of his policies, which are largely against Palestine and for the right-wing expansion of Israelis into the Palestinian territories.
Okay, thank you so much for that. James Thring, peace activist from London. Thank you. Iran says it has seized a smuggling tanker in the Persian Gulf region despite U.S. military intervention to help it escape. The seizure was made by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on July 6. An IRGC Navy commander said the vessel was carrying 1 million liters of smuggled Iranian diesel fuel. Ramzan Zarahi said the seizure was made upon the inspection of the vessel, whose captain was in contact with the U.S. Command and Control Center to help it flee. The U.S. also dispatched two A-10 fighter jets, a P-8 reconnaissance aircraft, two Seahawk helicopters, an MKU-9 drone, and several patrol vessels to help the smuggling tanker. Zarahi said Iranian forces warned them off and escorted the tanker to Bushehr port. The IRGC commander added that this is not the first time that the U.S. has sought to help smuggling vessels in the Persian Gulf, but it has been frustrated on every occasion. Over the past few days, we have been hearing reports that the U.K., France, and Germany are planning to maintain sanctions over Tehran's missile program, in violation of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iran has now reacted, saying such a move would be unconstructive. It has also pledged a serious and proportionate response. We discussed the issue in our news review program.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Tehran slams the joint statement by the UK, Germany, and France on retaining sanctions on all exports of military equipment by Iran over its missile program. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the move is not constructive and Tehran reserves the right to respond in kind. Earlier, the three European countries said they will maintain the sanctions, allegedly based on the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Well, the measures are due to expire in October, based on the sunset provisions in the resolution. Elsewhere in his remarks, Kanani reiterated using all available means to secure national rights with regard to peace for nuclear technology. He said indirect discussions are underway with parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. I'd like to invite my guests introduce my guests to this news review. Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert out of Washington, D.C., and Heinz Gartner, political science out of Vienna. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in D.C. What do you make of this, Yusuf, that the U.K., Germany, and France now are basically saying that they're going to continue their sanctions on the exports of military equipment by Iran.
It reminds me of 2020, October 2020, that the United States under President Trump, they wanted to extend the United Nations Security Council army embargo, the conventional military embargo against Iran. And this is not the mean that the JCPOA would be killed. No one would like to do that. Both sides know that the available option is not very important than restoring the JCPOA. But on the other hand, I think the Iranian would be very cautious about to see October 2025, which is the end date, the termination date of the this 2231 United Nations Security Council resolution. So perhaps Iranian would do everything to make sure that the deal is still alive to reach that moment. And it is very important, significantly important for Iran to make sure that the whole United Nations Security Resolution against Iran would be terminated soon after the 10 years after the JCPOA signed in 2015. But on the other hand, it has its options. So Iranian knows that if in any kind the European Union wanted to trigger the snapback mechanism and kill the deal, there are many options for Iran, like extending the enrichment over 90%, completely come out of the NPT and limit the IAEA's inspection, monitoring, and verification against Iran nuclear program, and even go further and maybe building a nuclear bomb. So Iran also put all leverage on the table to show the European Union that they need to keep their commitments under the deal.
Okay, well, Heinz, what do you think? I mean, when we're talking about the beginning of the story I read dealing with extended sanctions by the UK, Germany, and France, I mean, is this all about putting pressure on Iran due to the renewed indirect nuclear talks with the parties that were involved before, or your assessment of what's going on?
I think it should not come to a surprise that the E3 extend the sanctions. So the sanctions will be only relieved in the framework of the JCPOA, and we cannot expect the Europeans and for the Americans, for that matter, to relieve sanctions which are not negotiated outside of the JCPOA. So that the sanctions are retained, the cause for it is not the EU statement. The cause is the failure of the JCPOA. Of course, the original cause is that President Trump left the JCPOA in 2018, and it goes without saying that he violated international law because he violated also the UN Resolution 2231.
Okay, well, Yusuf, your take on this, because again, it seems like there's a higher standard for Iran than for other countries. I mean, your assessment of this, Yusuf.
So I believe that JCPOA is not worth it for Iran anymore if United States and European Union don't want to guarantee the benefits that Iran, the legitimate benefits that Iran would receive if the deal revived. So we can see that the United States said, even Biden administration, that we cannot guarantee anymore, not only for the next and future administration, but even for the Biden administration to abide by the commitment of the deal. So the only things that for Iran, there is a political motivation that Iran keep the deal and wanted the deal to be live again, is to reach to the October 2025, that the termination of the United Nations resolution sanction, all of the United Nations resolution sanction against Iran. And within that, I mean that Iran never threat the West. Iran don't want to threat the West. The point here is that Iran was in and still has been in the deal with the West, and the countries and the parties that they don't commit, they don't abide by the commitment is the United States, and unfortunately the European Union followed the United States policy. So here there is an option for Iran. If Iran don't want to put some leverage on the table, don't want to have some strategic card and build some strategic card to make and to force the Western countries, especially the European Union, that you have to still be in the deal and commit to your commitment. But on the other hand, as we know, the JCPOA after the United States left that is just still live with the political decision by the European Union and Iran, because both parties know that the alternative is much more dangerous. So okay. I'm quite sure that what's happening in the next few months would not be going to kill the deal, and still we have the deal for the next few hours, for the next few years.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with me. Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert out of Washington, D.C. Heinz Gartner, political science out of Vienna.
The Iranian capital is hosting the annual meeting of the Asian Parliamentary Assembly's Budget and Planning Committee. Parliamentarians from over 20 countries are attending the event in Tehran. The Speaker of Iran's Parliament has addressed the opening ceremony. Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf said that Asia is returning to the center of global economic and political power. He added that the return poses a challenge to the West. Ghalibaf noted that the current transition in the world order can pave the way for reviewing the structure of the international institutions like the United Nations. The APA has 42 member parliaments and 16 observers. It was formed in 2006 with the aim of developing common strategies and promoting peace in Asia and the world. The U.S. decision to provide Ukraine with cluster munitions continues to draw criticism from across the world. China has warned that supplying the widely banned weapons to Kiev could lead to humanitarian consequences.
The irresponsible provision of cluster munitions is highly likely to cause humanitarian issues. Humanitarian concerns and legitimate military and security needs should be addressed in a balanced manner, and the transfer of cluster munitions should be treated with prudence and restraint.
Mao said dialogue is the only viable way out of the crisis in Ukraine. She urged parties involved in the conflict to avoid fanning the flames of the war and escalating tensions. The U.S. has defended its decision to send Kiev cluster munitions, which have been banned by more than 120 countries. The controversial weapons release large numbers of smaller bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area and threaten civilians. And with that, we come to the end for this edition of World News. Because bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. New data shows that the UK housing market has slumped. According to new figures, demand for new homes in the UK has dropped as families cannot afford increased mortgage costs. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, house prices in the UK fell at the fastest annual rate seen in 12 years last month. Britain's major mortgage lender, Halifax, announced this week. Prices for June dropped for the third month in a row by 2.6% year-on-year, after a 1.1% fall in May, in the largest decline since June 2011, according to Halifax. The average cost of a home in Britain totaled £285,932 last month, the lender said in a statement. The latest slump comes as soaring mortgage rates, driven by a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, have sent jitters through the housing market. Kim Kennard, the director of Halifax Mortgages, said that the resulting squeeze on affordability will inevitably act as a brake on demand as buyers consider what they can realistically afford. Concerns about persistent inflation have led to a significant increase in the cost of funding, according to Kinnaird. Coupled with the base rate rising by another 5/10 percentage points to 5%, this contributed to a big jump in typical mortgage rates over the last month. With markets now forecasting a peak in bank rate of over 6%, the likelihood is that mortgage rates will remain higher for longer, and the squeeze on household finances will continue to put downward pressure on house prices over the coming year, he added. Traders are expecting the Bank of England to further increase rates to 6.5% by December, which would be the highest level since 1998. Analysts project house prices in the UK to drop as much as 10% from their peak in the summer of last year. Also in the UK, there are other concerning news about food insecurity. According to new data, 1 in 7 people in the UK faced hunger last year due to a lack of money. Research by food bank charity the Trussell Trust revealed recently. The survey said this equated to an estimated 11.3 million people, which is more than double Scotland's population. Ethnic minorities, disabled people, and carers were among those most affected, with researchers linking food insecurity to the cost of living crisis in the UK that is showing little sign of abating. The Trussell Trust runs more than 1,200 food banks across its network, which is around 2/3 of the UK total. The charity said it provided a record 3 million food parcels in the year to March, a 37% surge and more than double the amount delivered 5 years ago. It added that the latest findings were just the tip of the iceberg. About 7% of Britain's population was provided with charitable food support in the year to mid-2022, while 71% of people facing food shortages said they had not yet accessed any such support. Trussell Trust Chief Executive Emma Reevy said food banks are not the answer when people are going without the essentials in one of the richest economies in the world. We need a social security system which provides protection and the dignity for people to cover their own essentials, such as food and bills. UK households are facing the biggest two-year squeeze in living standards since records began in 1950s, as a spiraling inflation eats away at pay growth for workers in almost all sectors of the economy. The report said, this consistent upward trajectory exposes that it is weaknesses in the social security system of the UK that are driving food bank need rather than just the pandemic or cost of living crisis. Food inflation in the world's sixth largest economy was running at 18.3% in May and 14.6% in June, according to the most recent official data. Consumer price growth in Britain remains persistently high despite government efforts to tame inflation, with officials and trade unions accusing supermarkets of greedflation and profiteering at the expense of consumers.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Cluster bombs are banned by over 100 countries in the world due to their deadly effects. Now, they pose a high risk to civilian populations, and when the bomb explodes, smaller bomblets are released and can hit anyone. Many of these smaller bomblets remain unexploded for years before detonating. And some of these cluster bombs resemble toys, which have made them especially deadly for children. Now, with all of that information, why would the U.S. not listen to the will of over 100 countries and decide to send this illegal weapon to Ukraine? Stay with us as we take a look at that question and others on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests now to the program. Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the LaRouche organization out of Germany. Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute out of Texas. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Germany with Harley. I mean, why do you think that Washington is refusing to abide by the will of the majority of countries in the world to ban cluster bombs?
One is desperation. The Ukrainian counteroffensive is going nowhere. Biden has staked his re-election chances on success in Ukraine, and the inability to turn the situation around is causing a panicked reaction. Biden's excuse is because Ukraine is running out of weapons, and so are the NATO allies. Well, if that's the excuse, what happens when you run out of cluster bombs? You're going to start using tactical nuclear weapons. But the second reason is I think, the more important one. The United States is not abiding by international law. The idea of the rules-based order that the snake oil salesman Antony Blinken is running around the world talking about is a fake bunch of rules that basically are dictated by the United States to preserve the United States as a unipolar superpower. And that people are seeing through that now. The Global South is rising up against it. The resistance to that is clear every day, the de-dollarization and so on. So the U.S. feels compelled to have a show of force. But this actually is a sign of weakness, and I think they're going to regret making this decision. As you pointed out, there's an international convention, a treaty on cluster munitions, where even 21 out of 27 European Union states signed it, and 18 out of the 26 NATO members signed it. So,
okay. All right, stay with me. Yeah. Let me get Daniel in on this discussion. Daniel, cluster bombs are dangerous and civilians are especially vulnerable when they break up into smaller parts, flying and hitting anyone, as well as when they don't explode and last for years before detonating. How can Washington justify sending or using this type of weapon and at the same time play the human rights card with other countries over and over?
Well, the U.S. does hypocrisy pretty well. The U.S. government, I should say, does hypocrisy very well. And I agree with everything my colleague said, by the way. I think he made some very good points. The real issue, though, these cluster munitions will be put in 155-millimeter shells. These are not the kinds of huge bombs that the U.S., for example, dropped over Laos and Cambodia in the 70s. Ironically enough, they'll be less effective in the battlefield because there aren't these massive bombs that are being dropped. So they actually will have less effect in the battlefield. President Biden just said it outright. We're running out of weapons, and this is all we have left. It's a temporary measure. And indeed, as you suggest, it really is thumbing your nose at international conventions. But most interestingly, I think, this is the first we've seen of real cracks in the so-called Western alliance against Russia. Because as you point out earlier, the majority of the U.S.'s NATO partners have not only signed the international convention, but have passed domestic laws outlawing the use of or provision of such weaponry, and also the same is true in the EU. So you're seeing the U.S. going against its allies. We've already seen cracks in the alliances anyway. You're seeing a lot of restiveness. If you look in Germany, for example, you're seeing the rise of the AfD party. You're seeing the rise in France of the Le Pen National Party. So you're seeing a lot of these things happening, bubbling up. And to that, as the neocons will do, they lit a match and poured in some fire. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
Well, Harley, you heard what Daniel said about American allies expressing their dissatisfaction at the U.S. decision. But tell me, do they not have any say at all in what Washington do? I mean, if they're a close ally, tell me about that side of things.
Well, first of all, let me simply say it's good to be on with Daniel. It's been a while since we've spoken. The points you made were quite important, but the question you're asking, when did the European allies stand up to the United States and the United Kingdom so far in this situation? The perfect example is Germany. Germany's energy supply was destroyed by the attack on the Nord Stream pipeline. As Seymour Hersh pointed out, and no one's really refuted Hersh, this was done by Biden or by the United States, and the Germans refused to raise a peep about it. That's why the AfD, the conservative, the nationalist party in Germany, is making gains, because people see no one in Germany defending national interests. The same thing in France. French society is splitting apart. The Dutch government just fell. The European countries have been silent and have served as vassals to an Anglo-American war machine. And unfortunately, there are very few people on the political scene that are standing up against this. And that's the most important thing, is the people have to get out and be heard. We really do need not just an anti-war movement, but a movement against the military-industrial complex, which is controlling politics in every single one of these countries of NATO, the Five Eyes, and the United States.
Well, Daniel, the Russian embassy in Washington has condemned the U.S. for sending to ban cluster munitions to Ukraine. The embassy has written that the White House has confessed to committing the war crimes by admittingly sending these illegal weapons to Ukraine. So what's going to happen? So that they have admitted to doing this. So now what? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it really speaks to the bloodthirstiness of the American neocons who are running the show right now, because we know that these munitions are going to kill some Russians, but they're also going to kill a lot of Ukrainians when they retreat, as they have been doing. It's going to be blood all around. But the other issue is that the Russians have been restrained thus far in the use of these types of munitions, but they have millions of them in their arsenal. So I think their response is going to be, okay, so that's how the game is played now. Well, we have plenty of those to go around as well. And so who suffers the most? Well, these are the Ukrainians who are getting plucked off the streets and literally kidnapped by the government, had a gun forced into their hands. Some of these are not of military age, let's be honest. I mean, they'll get a guy like me and put a gun in his hand, God forbid. But this is what's happening, and they're getting out there and getting blown up. So the callousness of U.S. foreign policy is really astonishing, and I think the world is waking up and seeing it slowly, not quickly enough, but slowly but surely.
Well, based on what you've said, Daniel, do you think that gradually the mainstream media story about basically that Ukraine is winning, is that starting to crack? Is that starting to fall apart? Are the pieces being put together, you think, or not for people?
Well, the sentient people do understand this, but the mainstream media is far from sentient. We have government media in America, and that's it. We have government media and semi-independent media. But it's very obvious to any person with a couple of brain cells that if the Ukraine is winning narrative is the narrative, then why are you even admitting that you're scraping the bottom of the barrel for these weapons, because we don't have any more? Like, these two don't go together. It's impossible for both. It's, you know, it's like 1984. You can't have two opposing thoughts at the same time.
Yeah, well, what do you make of, Harley, what do you make of Biden's comments? I mean, saying that basically it was a hard decision, but running out of munitions. I mean, it's so odd for a party to say that in a war, but then at the same time try to continue the narrative that the spring offensive, or I guess the summer offensive now, is successful.
I'm not sure we can make much of a judgment on Biden's mental state. You know, between tripping over sandbags and tripping over his own tongue, what he says is actually not so important. What's important is what they're doing in his name. Now, remember, a couple of years ago when Psaki was his press secretary, she said use of cluster bombs are a war crime. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, well, we're using them. So the hypocrisy is so clear, and I think most of the world is waking up. The question is, what will wake up the sleeping giants, the populations in the United States and Western Europe? And you know, seeing Biden making such contradictory statements doesn't create a lot of confidence in American leadership. So how do you, on the one hand, assert America is the sole superpower and can make all the rules, and then it's making rules that go against international treaties? It's not going to last for much longer. And the question really is, what happens after this war is over? And I think people are beginning to get the point that Ukraine is not going to win. Ukraine is not going into NATO. And we're going to soon find out exactly how bloodthirsty the Ukrainian leadership is by going along with this proxy war. They're killing their own people. Daniel said it. Who's going to die from these cluster bombs? It will be Ukrainians. Some of them will be Russian ethnics. Many of them will be Ukrainian nationals. They're going to be the victims of this decision.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Daniel, I mean, when the West has sent hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Ukraine, which has not led to its victory, does it really think the cluster bombs are going to turn the tide? Or is it simply that they want to inflict as much harm as possible? I'm trying to get an understanding of this.
Well, the one thing that's very interesting, if you look at U.S. military spending, we spend more than the next 8 or 9 countries, I forget what it is now, combined, right? We spend well over $1.5 trillion a year when all combined together on military spending. Yet, I think Americans might start thinking, especially middle class and working class Americans who are really getting hit hard with our economic downturn, they may ask, why do we have to spend $1.5 trillion a year, shovel a couple hundred billion of it over to Ukraine, and you're telling me we don't have any weapons? Well, where the heck does the money go? It's supposed to buy weapons. Where's it going? And I think hopefully they'll scratch their head and they'll look around at some of the mansions around the Beltway in Washington, D.C., and understand this is an absolute massive Ponzi scheme, whereas the rich are preying upon the poor in America and handing them a flag in return. Hey, wave this. You're patriotic. Now give me your money. Hopefully that won't last much longer.
Well, Harley, you mentioned something earlier in the program about basically, when Biden said he had no choice but to send Kiev the cluster bombs because they were running low. And you mentioned, well, let's look at this, because based on that logic then, perhaps they feel like nuclear weapons would be next. I mean, if there's no limits, which obviously there seems to be no limits here, that they are sending these illegal munitions now, I mean, I would think that there would be such fear actually in the whole world with hearing this statement. I mean, your take, Harley.
Well, you have to realize that there are people in the Pentagon planning and in the intelligence community who have been gaming out the idea of how to win a limited nuclear war, that there are documents that have been prepared over the years and updated, and this idea of almost $1 trillion going into the defense budget. They are planning on how they think they can overcome what are, at this point, disadvantages. The U.S. is terribly unprepared for a war against China, and yet we're pushing it aggressively. We've seen this question of running out of weapons. You know, the British defense minister said if Britain ended up in a war, if NATO ended up in a war with Russia, they'd run out of ammunition in less than a week. And yet they're flexing the muscles and threatening the Russians and poking them in the eye as much as they can. One provocation after another. It's a classic case of the emperor has no clothes. The question is, who will stand up and say that? Why is there no one in the U.S. Congress? There are a couple of people, actually, who have raised this, including some Democrats and Republicans. But why is there not a massive outcry against this kind of policy? And it's a pure sign, a clear sign, that Biden is not mentally competent to serve as president and commander-in-chief.
Well, Daniel, what about that? Who is going to stand up? Let's look at the European side, because they have the most to lose. I mean, they're the closest to the war zone. And as Harley just said, with the UK basically saying they probably would have enough weapons for a week if they got into a war with Russia, how likely are we going to see more of a split between the Europeans and the Americans on this as this continues?
Well, hopefully not much longer, but the European leadership has sure shown itself willing to be a punching bag of Washington. We'll see how long that lasts. But, you know, the other important component of this is you suggested people on Capitol Hill. Within Biden's own party, this is the first time we've seen a split among people that have backed Biden's war, who we might be surprised that we're backing this war because they've had careers as anti-war members of the Progressive Caucus. When there's a Republican in office, they've backed this war. But there's something about cluster munitions, and maybe it's because Princess Diana and all of these campaigns against them, they have a different tone. Yeah, depleted uranium is awful. Let's not be in joke about it, but there's something about cluster munitions, cluster bombs. It's such a horrible thought comes to mind that you're seeing people from the president's own party saying, hey, this is a step too far. And that's dangerous for him because he's lost his European allies in the majority on this. He is losing his allies on the Democrat side. Now, most of the Republicans are brain dead. They want to do more. Lindsey Graham wants to have nuclear war tomorrow. That's different. But when you're starting to see cracks in his own Democratic coalition, hey, that's a bridge too far, Mr. President, then I think you're seeing some desperation. And I'm starting to wonder whether, as my colleague Harley points out, that the president does seem to have some deficits upstairs. Maybe they're looking for a way to ease Biden out, and this might be the thing they're using. Who knows?
Right. Well, because one would think that prior to making such an important decision, Harley, that there would be a lot of assessment of the pluses and the minuses and other choices. I mean, is that not the case in the Biden cabinet? Or is it simply that the neocons are ruling and this is what they want and that's the way it is?
I think you're giving too much credit to the people in the Biden cabinet. If you look at the key proponents of this war, people like Blinken, Sullivan, these are corrupt people. Blinken, between his service under the Obama administration and then coming back in under Biden, set up a consulting firm that made tens of millions of dollars working with the war machine. The defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, is a board member of Raytheon. You know, to the extent they are mentally competent, they're looking at this as money-making and reasserting American hegemony. Are there people who can think? Maybe on lower levels you have some people who would say something, but look what happens when there are whistleblowers. The Ellsberg case comes to mind. The Julian Assange case comes to mind. If you're in the establishment on the inside and you raise questions too strongly, you're facing being charged under the Espionage Act, going to jail for the rest of your life, having a kangaroo court frame-up. So I think between the corruption and the fear, and also just the plain venality and stupidity of these cabinet officials, Avril Haines, by the way, who's the National Intelligence Director, also worked with Blinken and this West exec consulting firm. So, you know, the United States has lost it. The Democratic Party, which used to be anti-war and free speech, is now the party of suppression of free speech and pro-war. So we've seen a dramatic shift downward in U.S. political thinking. But I think when you see that Daniel and I are in essential agreement on this, we're seeing people from the libertarians, from the left, the right. We're starting to see the emergence of a potential peace movement internationally. But it's got to come together really quickly.
Well, Daniel, now Russia has talked about all of this, that basically it shows an act of desperation on the part of the United States and signals its weakness. Your perspective on that?
I think it's pretty obvious that that's the case. You know, that the U.S. Remember, at first we were going to only send helmets because we didn't dare even send a pistol. That's how it started. But the neocons have no reverse gear. They only know how to escalate. But each escalation, remember, each wonder weapon, send us javelins, Saint Javelin, it did nothing. Send us HIMARS. HIMARS didn't have any strategic effect on the battlefield. And the Russians soon figured out how to block them, you know, and this sort of thing. And the drones they've been able to get rid of. The tanks now, they've lost 25% of their Bradley of armored vehicles, according to the U.S. military. So none of these wonder weapons are making a difference on the battlefield, and that's because to the Russians, this is an existential war. They were reluctant to enter this war. You know, Putin spent years from 2007 in Munich. He spent years saying, guys, stop doing this. This is not necessary. Don't keep pushing it. And nobody listened. They basically, what happens in Washington is they believe their own rhetoric. Russia is weak. Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. It goes on, and they believe what they say. And so when it happens, it turns out that, gosh, that's actually not the truth. When you're fighting for what you believe is your very existence, then you happen to fight a little bit better than the others.
Right. Well, Harley, what is it going to take to end these double standards and end this rule-based international order that basically allows Washington to do whatever it wants and to create so much havoc in the world without having to answer to it?
Well, I think what you're dealing with is this question of the delusional nature of the political leadership who may actually believe the narratives that are being put out by the mainstream media. But reality is going to assert itself. The fact that they've run out of ammunition, that's reality. You can promise all the weapons you want, but if you can't produce them, what happens? If Ukraine is consistently pushed back with their offensive, you can say the counteroffensive is going to succeed, but reality is saying something different. And now we're seeing something, a new factor brought in, which is the global south. The Blinken went around Africa and tried to bully African leaders to support the isolation of Russia. And they just told him, you can't come here and tell us what to do. We're a sovereign nation. Mm-hmm. And I think we're starting to see a shift where around the world people are beginning to realize that the emperor has no clothes and that sovereignty is the name of the game. And but that, by the way, is what's happening in Europe with the Le Pen movement, with the AfD in Germany. Maloney's been a real catastrophe so far in Italy, but some of the people behind her are trying to break out of that. So I think the future is going to rest with those countries that put the idea of the sovereign needs of their nation and their people first. And at some point, that will force a change, either that or the complete smashing of Ukraine by the Russian military if Putin lets up a little bit of his restraint.
Okay, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Out of Potsdam, Germany, Harley Schlanger, spokeswoman of LaRouche Organization, Lake Jackson, Texas, Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIV English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is with me in the studio to answer questions on Islamic beliefs. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, we know that except Imam Ali alayhi salam, for about 5 years to establish a government in Kufa, was the caliph of the Muslim Ummah, no other Shiite imams had the chance of establishing a government or politically sit on the seat of power. At the same time, there were so many other people from different dynasties, like, for example, Umayyads, Marwanids, Abbasids, and so many others who reached the power. They established their own governments. We can say, what was the main reason for doing so? Was it that the imams themselves did not consider any right for themselves to establish a political government because, for example, they believe that political government will lead into deviation or deviate them from the right path? Or no, they were not given the chance to establish, we can say, a powerful government.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, it's not only about Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was in power for 5 years. Imam Hassan alayhi salam, our second imam, also for a short period of time, he was in power, and then the power went to Muawiyah. There are a couple of points to be mentioned here. First of all, if we mention that Imam Ali alayhi salam was in power only for 5 years, does it mean that he was not the caliph of the time? As for the Shia, the caliph after the Holy Prophet is Imam Ali alayhi salam. From the time that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family passed away, the caliph of the time, the imam of the time, it doesn't make any difference.
Yes.
Is Imam Ali alayhi salam. After him, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, then Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and up until our time, in which the imam of the time is Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. So the only issue is the, apparent rulership over the Islamic society and Islamic community and nation. Yes, for that, people also should will and should ask the imams alayhi salam to be in power. So if Imam alayhi salam sees that people are going to other people, and for the first, second, and third caliphs, so in that times, only the apparent caliphate of Imam Ali salam cannot be manifested to the people, because this is the will of the people. And Imam Ali salam cannot force the people to accept him as the ruler, as the caliph of the time. But the imam is Imam Ali salam for sure. I mean, the Shia, even at that time, they refer to Imam Ali salam. And the Shia at the time of the next imam, for every issue, they used to refer to the imam of the time.
Yes.
And if the conditions and the situations were there, even for judgment, they used to refer to the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So this is one point.
Okay.
The second point is that from the time of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam onwards, after the Imam Hassan alayhi salam accepted the peace treaty with Muawiyah, we see that the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam do not find the situation ready for them to come into the power. For the same reason that Imam Ali alayhi salam was away from power for 25 years and then he accepted the request of the people, for the same reason, from the time of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, after that short period, other imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam were not able to have the physical power to come into the rulership. And it doesn't mean that they didn't want power, because based on the verses of the Quran and the narrations, we do believe that Islam has a plan for governing the society. We have the political system in Islam, and this is rooted in the verses of the Quran and the lifestyle of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. The Holy Prophet established a government in the city of Medina. There is no doubt about that. Imam Ali alayhi salam for 5 years he established a government. Also Imam Hassan alayhi salam for some months.
Okay.
But the other Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam could not realize this Islamic obligation because the people did not want them to do so. It doesn't mean that they didn't want to act upon this obligation. No, one of the factors which make this obligation to be fruitful is the willingness of the people.
Yes.
So if people are not going to help you, to support you in establishing a government, then you're not going to be able to successful. There are some narrations.